Returning now to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker in Worcester with his daily press briefing.
The CEO and their organization for their collaboration, creativity with respect to setting up and standing up this step-down facility for COVID-19 purposes as we approach what everybody believes will be the surge of patients and the need for additional hospital and step-down capacity here in Massachusetts over the course of the next month or so. I also want to say thank you to the Army National Guard, to the General, General Keefe, who's behind me here, and to Sam Phillips, who's the head of our MEMA operation, for their work both on this site and their work in collaboration with the City of Boston and the hospitals there on the Boston site. And we continue to talk to and work with the Army Corps and with some of their contractors, AshGrid here and EDS and others, about the possibility of putting up other sites here in the Commonwealth to ensure that we have the capacity that we need to serve people who still need to be attended to but probably don't need to be in a hospital, so that we can maintain the hospital capacity that we need to serve not just people who are dealing with COVID, but also people who are dealing with other medical conditions over the course of the next 5 or 6 weeks. We also, the Lieutenant Governor and I both got an update today on Holyoke Soldiers Home. Val Liptak and the team there have gotten a ton of support from the Guard and from others as they continue to do everything they possibly can to make sure that the people who are there are tested and that the operation is safe. At this point in time, I think all of the residents have been tested, and they are now in the process of making sure that the entire staff gets tested. This process is being led by a mobile testing unit that the Guard put up, which we plan to use around the Commonwealth to test people at nursing homes generally. And I think you'll see this continue to happen over the course of the next couple of months. As I said yesterday, the Holyoke Soldiers Home is a place that the Lieutenant Governor and I and others have visited multiple times over the course of the last few years, and it's always been a joy to be there. It was for the family members who were usually there, talking to them about the way the place was looking after and taking care of their family members was always positive. The conversations and the discussions with many of the residents about their time in the military and their time at the home was, for me anyway, uplifting. I never spent less than an hour there. And I considered it to be one of the best places we had in the Commonwealth for our military families. We hired Mark Perlstein this morning, who is a former first assistant prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Massachusetts, is currently a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery, to conduct an independent investigation with respect to what happened. And when it happened, and what didn't happen, and what didn't, and when it didn't happen, and the period leading up to the discovery on Sunday night about what the state of play was there. And we are going to make sure Mark and his team have access to all the services and all the people that they need access to get to the bottom of what took place. And the final thing I just want to say is I want to give a big shout out to Val. She's an incredibly talented and credentialed medical professional. She's done a terrific job as both the chief operating officer and as the CEO at Western Mass Hospital. She stepped into this on several hours' notice, and based on the conversations we've had with her, is really sharp and exactly the right kind of person, with the support of the Guard and others from our administration and from elsewhere, to rewrite the operation there. And with that, I do want to give the Lieutenant Governor, we're in her backyard, she knows all the players here, a chance to say a few words about this setup and the work that's being done in conjunction with UMass to prepare for the surge. Thank you.
Thank you, Governor, and good afternoon, and welcome to my hometown area. I have to say that I'm quite proud that Worcester, Massachusetts, is standing up the first medical field hospital here in our Commonwealth. Let me just start by saying it's hard to believe that a few weeks ago, the governor declared a state of emergency. And it seems, I'm sure for all of you, that a few weeks ago, our lives were very different and seemed so far away from where we are today. Like you, I wake up and feel mixed emotions. You know, as a mother, seeing my kids access their online learning, or at least try to do the best they can there. As a mother with my husband, not to see them play their sports and be on the sidelines with friends and enjoying those kinds of activities. Life has changed so much for all of us, and it's right to feel those mixed emotions when you wake up. But I will tell you, and I'm sure the governor feels the same way, there's one emotion that I feel every single day, and that is the one of feeling inspired by what we see literally in the view of our screens on TV or in social media, or by what the governor and I see in our work every day. And that's the amazing ability for our first responders and emergency responders to leave their families, to put on gear that they wouldn't normally put on, and to get out there and serve and protect the people of their community and of this Commonwealth. In particular, to see the frontline medical community do amazing work without question, going into rooms with sick patients, literally coming into contact with the part of humanity that is diagnosed with this illness and helping them recover is just really, to all of us, really amazing to see. But I think we all feel very grateful that we have these brave men and women among us doing that work for us every single day. And unfortunately, they'll be at it for a lot longer and certainly deserve our prayers and support. I want to just express how grateful I am to UMass Medical, and in particular, Dr. Eric Dixon. I had a conversation with him at the beginning of this effort, and he said, LG, don't worry, I got this. This is what I'm made for. I know how to do this. You know, I'm an emergency medicine professional, and I've been here, and I'm ready to take this on. And I was able to listen in to the UMass command meeting that they have every morning. And although I physically wasn't there, I felt an incredible sense of collaboration, professionalism, support to each member of that team to make decisions in the best interest and health of the people that UMass would need to serve. And for them to literally, you know, raise their hand and say, we can set up this bed capacity, which we know we will need because we do not have enough capacity in our ICUs to handle the patients that need the care there and the ones that are stepping out of that care into a less acute need without setting up a field hospital like this. And to see them literally greet the trucks coming in and to unpack this equipment, and it literally medical students graduating online yesterday that will be coming into this facility to care for the individuals in our community is really outstanding, and I couldn't be more proud of the UMass team. I would like to give a sort of a call to action on behalf of Dr. Dixon. While this is a physical setup, it doesn't work without the professional people here to staff it. And at full capacity, with 250 beds full, they will need docs and residents and registered nurses and personal care associates to help take care of this population of people. So he's recruiting volunteers to step up and devote their time to help with this effort. You can go online to their website, fill out the application, and be part of the team to help fight back the COVID-19 epidemic here in our Commonwealth. The other group that I'd like to acknowledge is the City of Worcester, because UMass has partnered with the City of Worcester to stand up this facility, to operate it and staff it. And I can't help but think that the city of Worcester is ready for this moment, but they're made for this moment. And it's perhaps because the city has had experience managing through crises in the past. I think many of you think of Worcester and you think of our fire service and how impacted it has been over these past decades. And so they are clearly able to rise to this occasion and to work in partnership with the federal government, with UMass, to set up this facility and to serve. So today, I hope that in the midst of the chaos and the sadness and the disruption that COVID-19 brings to all of us, that you too feel inspired by the amazing men and women who literally are gowning up and gearing up with more protective equipment on the way to help them do their jobs to make people healthier and safer, not only through this crisis, but to be prepared after it, to be ready to get back into the routines and lifestyles that we so appreciate. So thank you. For those of you interested, join the effort if you have the medical training and background and be available to volunteer and serve. Thank you.
Thanks, LG. Questions? Well, first of all, part of the point behind having an independent third party come in to investigate the current state of play there is to make sure that we get answers to many of the questions that people have. And that's exactly why we hired Mark Perlstein to come in and do that. I don't anticipate anything other than this point, other than a thorough investigation by a trained professional who has an outstanding reputation, who I believe will give us what we want, which is answers to what happened there and what went wrong and why. And what we can do to make sure it doesn't happen again.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's daily briefing on the coronavirus from the DCU Center in Worcester.
Well, Chelsea Soldiers Home is a terrific institution, and Cheryl Poppy is a spectacular leader, and she has a great team. And they followed all the rules and protocols that they're supposed to follow with respect to both operating an elder care facility in a time of COVID-19 and reporting on critical incidents when they occur. My understanding is there was one death reported day before yesterday, I think, and a second death reported either last night or this morning. So there are two. Pardon me? Yep. Everybody who was transferred was tested, which is the appropriate protocol. And the person who was tested positive was not transferred because they tested positive. And the reason we knew they were positive was because everybody who was going to be transferred was tested. And the point behind that exercise, and this is important, in other states that have seen big-time enhancements in the number of people they have to serve and the population that they need to treat as they head into a surge have ended up putting a lot of people who didn't need hospital-level care but were COVID positive into facilities, step-down facilities like skilled nursing facilities, in the same facility with people who aren't COVID-19 positive. We don't happen to think that's the right way to handle this. We think the way to handle this is to do everything we possibly can to keep our elders, especially those in nursing home institutions and institutions that are designed to treat non-COVID people, and to do all the things that our guidance and the other guidance that's put out by the feds and everybody else is designed to keep people from contracting COVID in the first place, and then set up skilled nursing level of care that is staffed and organized and geared specifically to treat people who are COVID positive but ought not to be in an acute care facility similar to this one here.
Are the residents expected to be
I don't know exactly what's going on resident by resident, but I can tell you that Val understands all the protocols associated with how to deal with this, and she's implementing them with the help of some of the staff who were there and a bunch of medical folks from the Guard. Well, keep in mind that there are two for sure, one here and one at the BCEC in Boston. We're also looking at other sites around the Commonwealth and are basically in daily conversations through the command center with our colleagues in the hospital community to determine where else we may need capacity, not just field hospital capacity, but also additional skilled nursing capacity as well. And we literally are thinking about this regionally. You know, what are we doing? This is sort of like what I would describe as central Mass, right? But there are going to be ultimately strategies for the Cape, for the South Coast, for Western Mass, for Merrimack Valley, and for Boston. And each strategy is going to be based on the existing capacity that exists in each of those places and what people's anticipated requirements in a surge are going to demand. And we're going to do everything we can to make sure that we put in place the capacity that people believe they need so that not only, as the Lieutenant Governor said, we can serve the people who are dealing with and battling their way through COVID, but that we also can continue to serve people we have traditionally served in our healthcare system who don't have a COVID issue, but may have an acute medical need or a nursing need that need to be served as well. Well, the first thing is that I'm pretty sure that the appointments made by the board always has been. They always wanted to create a certain distance between the facility and the administration. But part of the review is going to determine what actually happened and who didn't do what and who did over the course of the period to be studied. And obviously, the superintendent's performance during that period is going to be part of that review. I don't think we're looking at the possibility of another Holyoke and Chelsea. No, I don't. But I will tell you that one of the reasons why we put so many protocols in place over the past 3 or 4 months with respect to assisted living facilities, congregate care facilities, nursing homes, and elder care facilities is because there's no population that's more at risk when it comes to this particular contagion than seniors, and especially those who live in quarters that are designed to serve them. And in every part of the country, people are working to come up with strategies and approaches to do everything we possibly can to protect this population. And that's true here in the Commonwealth as well. I can't answer that question at this point in time, but part of the reason we created the mobile testing unit was so that we could work our way around the elder care community and test people accordingly. I think we're going to have a lot more to say about gear tomorrow, and I'm going to leave it at that. Pardon me? I'm going to talk about it. We're going to talk about it tomorrow. I mean, look, I've expressed significant concerns about a lot of things associated with gear over the course of the past 2 or 3 weeks, and I've also said that we've been working a variety of processes and opportunities to make sure that we have the gear that we need to serve our medical community and our first responders and our emergency medical community. And I've also said that I expected to have more information on this later this week, and I do. We're still putting that together with each region. Remember, we're not thinking about this as a statewide number. We're thinking about it based on each region of the Commonwealth. And that number depends a lot on how many other kinds of beds you have. Because remember, this is a question about throughput, right? If you have a certain amount of capacity like this, or like Beaumont, or like the field hospital that's going to get put up at the BCEC, or some of the other step-down facilities that we're developing, then the number of ICU beds you need changes, okay? Because the whole point here is that most people will need to be at one level of care for a certain period of time, and then another level of care. So from our point of view, the real question is, how many of each level do you need? And based on how many of each you have, how many of the other levels do you need to actually meet the demand for services during that period of time? And those numbers, they change based on how many units you think you have, how many beds you have, how much staff you have at each level of care. Pardon me? I guess what I would say is we're going to expect that Mark will be diligent, and we'll make sure that whatever he needs is available to him. But I don't want him to rush this. I want him to get it right. And I think I speak for every single family and every single person who worked there and everybody who cares about that place, that at the end of the day, what we really want is the right answer. Pardon me? You know, the hard part about calculating recovery is people aren't required to tell us, okay? And one of the reasons why we've been so aggressive about expanding our testing is because we want to know two things. Number one, how many people are we testing who are positive so that we can actually act on that and do the follow-up work with respect to making sure that those who've had close contact with them know that they've tested positive. And the second is to actually start to develop what I would call an appreciation and understanding of where a lot of the positives are landing so that we can make decisions around things like how we're going to organize our healthcare capacity to deal with the surge based on some of that data as it comes in. You should know that we're now, we're either number three or number four with respect to the most number of tests issued by any state. The only two states that I think are ahead of us at this point are New York and Washington. But I think in many ways, the testing piece is a key part of how you ultimately get an understanding and appreciation about where your resources need to be deployed and what you need to do to deal with this. Remember, you know, somewhere between 20 and 25% of the people who are deemed infected by COVID based on the CDC's analysis of this are asymptomatic. So the fact that a lot of people who get tested come back negative, that's a good thing to know. But in addition, the thing everybody should understand here is there are a lot of, the whole point behind social distancing, right? The whole point behind all this work that we're doing, all the disruption we're creating for people, all the major changes in the way we live, is about keeping people far enough away from each other for a long enough period of time that people don't pass this from one person to the next. And I can't express how important that is, not just for people who are symptomatic, but also for people who are asymptomatic. If really 20% or 25% of the folks who are infected with this are never going to show symptoms for this, it's really important that we all respect that and do everything we can to stay away from each other.
This is WBUR. You're listening to live coverage of Governor Charlie Baker's coronavirus briefing from the DCU Center in Worcester.
The big conversations we're having right now with our colleagues in education are about what are we going to do to make sure kids actually learn something between now and the end of the year. The I'm sure that my kids are in their 20s, so this is less of an issue for me than it is for the lieutenant governor personally. I think it would be a shame if for the next 3 or 4 months, whether the kids go back to school sometime in May or not, they don't spend any time developing any more knowledge than they had when they got sent home. And I get the fact that it's complicated, but there are a lot of schools and a lot of teachers who are doing some really interesting things to keep in touch with and to provide educational opportunities for their kids. And we're doing everything we can when we come across these to share them with others and to encourage people to be as creative as they can be to provide kids with the educational experience that they need. The issue with respect to May 4th is a decision we're going to have to make at some point, and I get that. But I think what people really ought to be focused on is a little less on how do we turn summer vacation into starting tomorrow, and more into what are we going to do to make sure that whatever happens between now and the end of June, we're doing everything we possibly can as a Commonwealth and as communities and as school districts and as schools to make sure that kids don't end up having to view this as a completely lost opportunity to continue to grow and to continue to learn. That's my biggest concern at this point. Yeah. I can't answer that question. I can tell you that the conversations we're pretty deep into them at this point with the city and with some of the Boston hospitals, and I would expect that it would be sometime in the same time frame that we've been talking about here. Pardon me? I think part of the reason for trying to do it this way is if you create a unified site like that, you can actually, one of the nice things about this, and when you look out here, it looks a little barren and open at this point, but the bottom line is you have a lot of latitude to create a model that's been used in a lot of other places and been used successfully and to understand exactly what you need to actually stand up. I mean, the first time the Army Corps came to meet with us, they literally showed up with almost like a cookbook. And yeah, you call it a menu, I call it a cookbook. But like, these are the things we do, you know, and this is what works in this circumstance. This is what we do in this circumstance. This is what we do in this circumstance. And when you have an open floor plan like this, you have the flexibility to literally take one of these designs. It's basically built to be built quickly, to solve a particular set of problems, and it has been proven on a number of occasions to be successful, and do it. And that's a much easier answer than trying to find a way to work within the confines of the frameworks of either dormitories or hotels. I will say this, we expect and anticipate that in parts of Massachusetts, dormitories and hotels are going to be used for a variety of purposes that have to do with supporting healthcare workers, and in some cases probably used for isolation and quarantine opportunities. But I really do think this model, because it's proven and because everybody knows, generally speaking, what it is you need to do to stand one up, and it's been done a lot of times successfully, is probably a better way to create a step down than to try and force one into an existing structure that isn't really built for it in the first place. Say again. They were open last week?
Yes. Where is that?
That surprises me.
They shouldn't have been open last week. The only folks on the firearm side that have been essential in Massachusetts since we issued the initial order are manufacturers. No. The only thing that changed was the way it was codified in the federal essential business and essential worker list. But in Massachusetts, manufacturers were considered to be essential in round one, and they were considered to be essential in round two. Gun shops were not.
Thanks, guys.
Why would you consider suspending non-essential construction?
Non-essential? Can you define non-essential? We did define non-essential construction. We also defined essential construction based on the federal guidelines and criteria. The federal guidelines basically said healthcare facilities, essential construction. Okay? They also said transportation, essential construction. They said emergency work on utilities and telecom, essential construction, for a lot of reasons. I mean, everybody is trying to upgrade their telecom capacity right now because they have about 50 times as much traffic running through it as they had running through it 3 weeks ago. They also said housing is essential construction because they acknowledged that this country and this Commonwealth, by the way, has a terrible housing shortage, and not to continue to complete housing projects would be a big mistake. What they said was non-essential was office buildings, retail, and hotels. And so we basically adopted the federal standards around what was considered to be essential and what was considered to be non-essential. The other thing we did was we put out pretty stringent guidelines around what you needed to do this safely. And we basically said to cities and towns, these are our guidelines, they're what we're going to use on our projects, okay, which are considered to be essential because most of them fall into the infrastructure category that we just talked about. And we expect that you can either adopt these and enforce them, or if you need help enforcing them, ask us and we'll bring people who are trained inspectors to help you do that. Or if you want to do something else, you can do something else too. And if you don't deem projects in your community to be ones that you believe you can actually enforce and oversee successfully around the guidelines that we've put together with respect to what a safe site should look like, then you have the ability to prohibit that project from going forward. But there are certain kinds of projects in construction that were deemed by the feds to be essential, and we adopted those recommendations. Thanks, everybody.
This is WBUR's Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and you have been listening to live coverage of Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker's daily coronavirus briefing, which he delivered today from the DCU Center in Worcester. We took a break from our deeply compressed one-day spring fundraiser to bring you that live coverage. And WBUR's Anthony Brooks was listening in alongside us. He joins us now. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Tiziana.
So in listening, Anthony, for me, it felt like the big shift today was from if to when. This was all about planning for the massive healthcare needs we are anticipating in the Commonwealth. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And the governor and the lieutenant governor were in Worcester to talk about the setting up of this so-called step-down facility, which is going to be run by UMass Medical. And what this is essentially a field hospital that's going to be set up, and it's one of several that they're trying to position around the state so that it essentially takes pressure off of the ICUs and the services that hospitals will be providing for people who are really sick. And this allows them to transfer patients out of these hospitals and have them get the care that they need elsewhere to make room at the front lines, if you will, of medical care. And so he was talking about this field hospital essentially being set up there at the DCU, which is a big convention center in Worcester.
Anthony, we took the live feed from WCVB-TV. There was video as well. And I'm looking at this convention center. I'm thinking of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, you know, other disasters we've seen elsewhere. And the proportions of this come home as you see a mobile field hospital being set up in convention centers. Now there's talk of another in Boston. Are we ready?
Well, I mean, I think that's the hope. I mean, that's the question that I don't think any of us can really answer for sure. But I think Baker's talking about mobilizing resources from around the state to do all that they can do to be ready. But as you mentioned, this big convention center in Worcester, it is huge. I've seen it. I mean, it's where they, for example, hold the political conventions that have now been canceled. And they want to put in a full capacity 250-bed medical unit to essentially help people. And as to the question of are they ready, I mean, it's interesting. They're moving as fast as they can, but we heard Baker, or maybe it was Lieutenant Governor, talking about a call out for volunteers, people who have medical training. Maybe they're retired To come and work in these places because they need trained nurses and other medical professionals to staff it. And so they're in the process of getting as ready as they can be for what they regard as this surge, which is going to be coming within the next week or 10 days or so.
Anthony, the other big subject that got covered today, and there were some questions on it too, is the follow-up to the news of the deaths at the soldiers' home in Holyoke.
That's right.
I wonder if you could talk a little more about that.
Well, what we heard, and this was reported earlier, WBUR reported it, that the governor has hired Mark Perlstein, he's a former prosecutor, to conduct an independent investigation to determine what happened at the soldier's home in Holyoke and what didn't happen. What we know about Perlstein is he formerly served as the chief of the U.S. Attorney's Office of Economic Crimes Unit in Boston, and he was the first assistant U.S. attorney, according to the governor's statement. He's currently a partner at McDermott Will and Emery Law Firm, and it's going to be his job to figure out everything that led up to this tragedy of 13 deaths at this veterans' home out in Holyoke. And again, we heard Governor Baker repeating some of what he said yesterday, how he had visited this place on numerous times and called the soldiers' home a really extraordinary place that took care of veterans and family members, were very happy with it. So what happened was a real shock, a real tragedy, and they're taking it seriously and they want to get to the bottom of it.
Anthony, in our last 45 seconds or so, one of the things that was interesting is that Governor Baker got some questions about what he called gear, personal protective equipment. And
That's right.
He started just by saying, hey, I'll talk about that tomorrow. But he couldn't quite resist expressing some frustration again about that situation.
Yeah, I mean, he says he's going to be talking about this tomorrow. And as he said, you know, we've expressed concerns about this in the past, and they've been working a variety of angles to get the protective gear to the folks that they need. Those frustrations have included this difficulty of landing contracts, because in a sense, some of the states, Massachusetts included, end up in competition with the federal government. And that's been a real source of frustration for the governor. But apparently, he says he's going to have more information about whether the state has made progress getting hold of this essential protective equipment.
I'm going to have to take it back from you there, Anthony. Thanks to Anthony Brooks. This has been Radio Boston on WBUR.